This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up today, Meta overhauls information checking on its social media sites. We'll talk about the challenges Chinese companies face in the US market.
By definition, the very fact it's put on a blacklist really affects the reputation of that company and certainly affects the reputation of China as well.
After nearly a year-long block in crude oil exports, the flow of oil from South Sudan has resumed. We'll explore what it means for the region. Also today, while some countries are closing their trade borders, you'll hear about two nations that are taking a very different path.
The culture, the language, the people, the food, Singapore and Malaysia are so much alike. We're so similar, yet a little bit different.
That's all coming up here on World Business Report over the next 30 minutes. First, though, Meta has decided to end its fact-checking program on Facebook, Instagram and Threads. Instead, the social media platform is replacing it with so-called community notes. Now, these are similar to what you find on X, Elon Musk's X, where users are allowed to comment on the accuracy of posts. The move will be introduced in the US first. Meta's boss Mark Zuckerberg took to his own social media platform, Facebook, to explain why they've made the changes.
After Trump first got elected in 2016, the legacy media wrote nonstop about how misinformation was a threat to democracy. We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the US. So over the next couple of months, we're going to phase in a more comprehensive community notes system. As we work to promote free expression, I think that it will help us build trust to do this work in places where there is less concern about the bias of our teams.
Well, let's talk to Chris Vallance now. He is the BBC's technology reporter. We heard there from Mark Zuckerberg putting their reasons forward for why they're doing this. What's your perception on why they're doing this?
Well, I mean, here we are at the dawn of a second Trump presidency. And of course, for the right in the US, there's been this conflict with the social media platforms about what they describe as censorship. And in many times when these companies have clamped down on misinformation, the cry has gone up from quite a number of sort of right-wing voices that their views are being censored as a result, whether or not this is true. Of course, many people say fighting misinformation is really a sort of public service that stamps out dangerous untruths. But nonetheless, that has been a constant debate in the US. And of course, you know, Donald Trump and Mark Zuckerberg, as he has with several other social media heads, have kind of locked horns. Trump was suspended from Meta platforms, you may remember, shortly after sort of January the 6th. He's previously described Meta as a kind of enemy of the people. But now he won the election. Mark Zuckerberg has dined with him at Mar-a-Lago the day before Thanksgiving. He's donated $1 million to his inauguration fund. And there's many people perceive in this an effort to fit in and address those concerns on the right that they've been censored.
And is it, as you say, a move to fit in? Or do you think, you know, you talked about Mr. Zuckerberg and Mr. Trump together in Florida. Is there pressure possibly from Trump's presidential team to go in this way?
It's hard to say, isn't it? But I think, you know, if you are Mark Zuckerberg and you are looking at, you know, the power of figures like Elon Musk, and you're looking at his approach to free speech, he describes himself as a free speech absolutist. This replacement system to fact checkers is borrowed from X. You know, it's easy to see why he might think this was important. You know, and of course, he has been at loggerheads with various regulators. I mean, the regulators have been on their case, on Meta's case, on the tech platform's case, about are they doing enough to stamp out free speech? And, you know, you can't, you know, some of what he says, you know, may well be, you may well be able to take at face value. I mean, you know, he may well genuinely believe that, that some of the restrictions on his platforms have gone too far and that they are stifling, so, you know, political discourse.
What will it mean for users then, in a practical sense?
In a practical sense, the fact-checking system is going to work in a very similar way to the way that community notes work on X, which is kind of, if you like, a sort of a user-led effort to correct misinformation. There's a sort of rather complicated algorithm that sees when sort of people of who don't usually agree are, if you like, trying to write community notes on the same topic, and then community notes kind of get added and promoted to those posts on X. How it will exactly work on Meta, I don't think we have the details yet. But and it's going to begin its rollout in the US. It's going to be interesting to see how this approach plays in places like Europe, yeah, and
there are different
and other
rules.
Countries. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they've got their own very strong regulatory regime. And one of the things that Mark Zuckerberg said in this announcement was that he was looking forward to working with Donald Trump to push back as what he sees as excessive efforts to censor speech on the part of European the European authorities.
Chris Vallance, the BBC's technology reporter, thank you very much for joining us and explaining that for us. Well, let's turn our attention now to recent developments between the US Defense Department and the Chinese tech giant Tencent. The Pentagon has added Tencent, along with several other Chinese companies, to a list of suspected to companies which have suspected ties with Chinese military. This list is part of the US government's strategy to counteract what it sees as Beijing's efforts to increase its military power through technology. Tencent is known as a popular platform like WeChat, and it also invests in games like Fortnite, and it has strongly denied the allegations. Han Lin is the China country director of Asia Group. He works with US businesses in China. He spoke to me from Shanghai earlier, and he explains what this list is and what it means to be on it.
This list that's referred to, the 1260H, it was started under the U.S. National Defense Authorization Act to highlight companies with military ties in China. Now, it's a fairly general definition, but it really tries to capture companies that might be having dual-use technology to use on the civilian, but also benefiting the China military side. The challenge is this. Sometimes the types of companies that appear on this list can look very random. And even though it doesn't have the weight of sanctions, by definition, the very fact it's put on a blacklist really affects the reputation of that company, and certainly affects the reputation of China as well. So as you might imagine, China is not at all happy with this, and so they've put in their various obligatory complaints.
How do you think it might affect the companies that have been added to it in terms of their business?
It certainly is not helpful. Nowadays in global business, the various random inclusion of companies onto various blacklists, that seems to be a feature of business that's happening more and more. But the challenge is that it's not clear what the definition of some of the companies being on the list is. And so for Tencent, for example, they tend to be better known as a social media company and as a payments company. Now, they are in the U.S. right now looking to build their cloud business. So their inclusion into this list isn't going to be helpful at all. But the challenge is this. Even though it's not a sanction itself, it raises suspicion with all future business partners, including banks as well. So suddenly they have an increasing burden of trying to prove they're innocent.
Tencent have said that they have nothing to do with the Chinese military. Do you believe them?
I would not know. Okay, I would not know. And the reason I say that is, at least being in Shanghai, I use Tencent, as does everybody in China use Tencent, in terms of just social media, sending messages kind of like a Facebook in the US. But the challenge is that as companies including Tencent and Alibaba continually look to invest and to explore new technologies such as in the AI space, there's always the concern from various folks, is that AI actually being utilized by the military in any capacity? So that's where there are suspicions coming about, that dual use access. But I will tell you, as just a regular Shanghai person, I would not have thought or imagined that it would be on this 1260H list now.
So how does this fit in with the China-US relations, which aren't great at the moment?
It comes as a surprise. In fact, right now in China, there has been this signaling to just kind of keep quiet. Okay, China is not looking for any particular conflict with the U.S. There'll probably be more than enough activity happening after the first 100 days, once the new administration comes into play. But in a couple of weeks, you've got Chinese New Year. There's a heavy focus on the economy. There's a heavy focus on trying to improve consumption. So at the end of January into the first week of February, you have Chinese New Year. And then as you start moving into March, the first week of March, there's going to be the two sessions where the Chinese government's really going to define the parameters of economic growth and state what the economic growth target is. So the sudden inclusion of Tencent on this blacklist was probably not expected. And it certainly is a distraction that the government is hoping to avoid as it tries to really hunker down on the economy.
So as they sort of prepare for Donald Trump's inauguration, you wouldn't expect right now any retaliation from Beijing. That might come, I suppose, later in the year.
So the practice that China has had is, when the U.S. has an action, China will have an immediate reaction, but China tries to be proportionate. Okay, so we should expect something from the China side in the coming days. Possibly some inclusion of a U.S. company on its equivalent blacklist, but probably a company that doesn't do that much business in China in the first place. Primarily because as much as China may want to respond, it also doesn't want to slow down foreign investment by foreign multinationals into China either. So in that sense, they're trying to find the appropriate balance.
And what about the companies that you actually work with? How are they preparing for the next 4 years and these sort of what some might describe as tit for tat? America does one thing, China will retaliate. China does one thing, America will retaliate. How will companies cope with all of that?
You're absolutely right. As these U.S.-China dynamics really play out, it's really gotten more complex for U.S. companies in China. But there are a couple of differences. So, for example, if you happen to be in the technology side, yes, you're going to have much more risk exposure compared to somebody in the consumer goods space. But it also does matter what your business model is. If, for example, you're in China primarily to sell to Chinese consumers versus if you're in China to manufacture for global export, you're going to face a different degree of challenges. But definitely the commonality that everyone's focused on is, first, they hope U.S. and China try to find some level of equilibrium. And second, they hope that in the coming weeks, China will announce more stimulus to stimulate the economy in the hope that perhaps a rising tide can raise all boats.
That was Han Lin, the China Country Director for Asia Group. So how are investors feeling about this, especially Tencent investors? Let's have a chat with Fiona Sincotta. She is from Citi Index. So what's happened with their stock price?
Yes, not a good day for Tencent. The ADRs trading on the US, they're down 7%. So, you know, a sign that there's obviously some concerns over the impact of this move on the company.
And overall, though, we heard about Han Lin saying that, you know, those companies on the tech side are going to be more nervous going into the next 4 years. Do you see that in tech stock in Hong Kong?
I think that's a very good point. And I think that definitely is the case. You know, there is this sort of level of uncertainty and unknown. Obviously, we do have the previous Trump administration to sort of draw comparisons with. But until we actually know what those policies are going to be, then it does mean that there is that level of uncertainty. And I think that's just causing some caution. And obviously, as we go through the administration, I think it will probably quickly become quite clear what the stance that Trump is going to take and how aggressive that stance might be. And I think that will then be played out on the stock markets.
Fiona Sincotta, stay with us. We will come and talk to you again in a moment. You're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Now, Sudan's military-led government has lifted a 10-month block on crude oil exports from its landlocked neighbour, South Sudan, after the two countries reached new security arrangements. The country's energy minister says two oil blocks in Upper Nile State will restart operations, initially producing 90,000 barrels a day. Now, before the shutdown, South Sudan's daily output exceeded 150,000 barrels. Let's have a chat now with Dr. Matthew Benson. He is director of the Sudan and South Sudan Research Centre at the London School of Economics. Dr. Benson, thank you for joining us. Why did the Sudanese military remove this ban? What's happened? Explain to us that.
The country relies heavily upon, South Sudan is one of the world's most oil-dependent countries in the world. It really needs this oil turned back on because it's spiraling through a hyperinflation and a major economic crisis, which is rooted in a political bargain that relies upon oil in order to sustain everything. And then from the Sudanese side, this is a war economy that's been going on for over a year now, coming into its second year. There's a real need for additional sources of revenue in order to continue the fighting. So both sides are really in a kind of ultimate crisis mode. And it's really important that the oil is back on in order to sustain the economy in each.
And this crude oil will be shipped into global markets through a port on the Red Sea. How much money do you think can they expect in return for it?
As far as official figures, it's very difficult to verify those, especially from the South Sudanese side. So I think the biggest thing here would really be thinking about the countries that buy it. So these would be oil buyers in the UAE, Malaysia, China, and then, of course, Singapore, which is a major transshipment area for global trade for oil. So it kind of filters out into the global economy through there.
How did the block affect the South Sudanese economy?
It's been catastrophic for the South Sudanese economy. The South Sudanese economy, again, it's around 90% oil dependent. And again, it's not just about the economy. It's really a political bargain that's rooted in dispersing oil revenue to a ruling elite. And very little of that trickles down to everyday South Sudanese people. But the military, the country's always on the brink of a civil war. And so the oil money is used essentially to sort of keep salaries going to prevent people from finding reasons to fight. So that bargain has been really fragile and super shaky, including with a major fallout that happened in November just very recently. So I think there's a real attempt to sort of prevent that from happening again.
So at the moment, 90,000 barrels will be produced per day. As we said, though, but before the shutdown, it was 150,000 barrels. It will be important to kind of ramp that production up quickly.
It will be very important to ramp that up quickly. Whether that's possible is a different question, but it is very important for the leaders, the rulers of both of these countries, for that to happen. Again, something that I want to stress, though, is just because it's important for the rulers, for everyday South Sudanese, they're some of the poorest people in the world, and they're not really the beneficiaries of this, other than the country not going to war again. So there's a real need to actually increase transparency and oversight of these revenues, particularly from some of the major commodities traders, such as Transfigura and others, to really make sure that everyday people have more oversight over this. That could really shift this bargain and make it not just about a ruling elite doing stuff that doesn't impact everyday people or against their best wishes.
Does the move demonstrate that there will be a bit more stability in the region now?
Probably not. This is one of the world's most fragile parts, fragile regions. And until there's real pressure on the UAE and other sponsors of the major fighters in northern Sudan, it's unlikely that we're going to see something shifting. It's really hard to consolidate this territory. We're looking at a really fragile region which spans not just from South Sudan, but goes into Central African Republic, into Chad, and into Libya and other parts of the world, and Yemen and so forth. So it's really about the Red Sea arena, more so than it is about these two countries. Okay. And that's super fragile.
Dr. Matthew Benson from the South Sudan and South Sudan Research Centre at the London School of Economics. Thank you for joining us on the programme. We'll talk to Fiona Singh-Cotta again. Eurozone inflation then, that has risen to 2.4% in December, up from 2.2% the previous month. What are the factors contributing to the increase, Fiona?
Yes, that's right. So we are seeing an increase in inflation. I think the other thing to keep in mind here is core inflation, which basically removes more volatile items such as food and fuel, remained unchanged. So that remained steady at 2.7%. What that tells us is basically everything really, par food and fuel, seem to be fueling the increase in inflation. Obviously, you've got shelter, you've got housing costs, insurance costs have also been a problem, all sort of feeding into the increase in inflation.
And this comes off the back yesterday of Germany releasing their inflation data. It rose to 2.9% from a year ago in December, up 2.4% the previous month. And this is what we've been calling the sick man of Europe throughout the whole of 2024. Does it show it's recovering? Is it going to recover?
Yeah, I mean, this is really, it's really difficult news for us to really sort of take on board, because if we think about this, we've got very, very weak growth, potentially recession in Germany, and yet there's this inflation, which is proving to be really quite sticky. So we did have some celebrations over at the beginning of the summer that inflation was in fact cooling, but it feels that those celebrations were in fact a little bit premature. And this does raise a problem, obviously, for the European Central Bank and their ability to be able to cut interest rates across the rest of this year. They've got a meeting at the end of this month where they are expected to cut rates by 25 basis points, but expectations of a larger rate cut by 50 basis points have pretty much evaporated.
And Germany's heading to the polls next month in an election. We saw what happened yesterday in Canada with their kind of cost of living crisis. It's going to play out in the polls as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this is something that we've seen in quite a few countries now, where there's been sort of this unhappiness among the electorate regarding the state of inflation and what that means for households, their ability to be able to spend.
It's very difficult. Thank you very much, Fiona Singh-Cotta from City Index, for joining us today on the programme. Now, while a global trade war might be brewing between the US and its trading partners, Malaysia and Singapore have taken a different approach. They've signed a new trade partnership aimed at enhancing economic integration, attracting global investment and creating new opportunities on both sides of the border. Zan Asli is a journalist based in Kuala Lumpur, and he describes how close these two countries are.
Singapore and Malaysia are so close. They used to be in the same country. Singapore used to be part of Malaysia right up until 1965, when they decided to separate and form their own independent state. Before this, there was just one bridge. It was a causeway, actually, linking Johor, the city of Johor Bahru, to Singapore. And if you cross this causeway, it would only take you 5 minutes to get to Singapore if you're driving a car or on a motorcycle. So it's really, really nearby, very close by. I actually grew up in Johor Bahru, and I remember when as a kid, every weekend we would go to Johor Bahru. My mother would be working, and they would go to Singapore for lunch and then come back to Johor Bahru. And you know, the culture, the language, the people, the food, Singapore and Malaysia are so much alike. We're so similar yet a little bit different.
So that area that you just talked about, where you used to go as a little kid, that's going to be the area of this new economic zone, isn't it?
I think the economic zone is going to be a little bit north of the city of Johor Bahru. The size is quite large. It's supposed to be about 4 times the size of Singapore. So it's a big piece of land that has been dedicated for this zone, yeah.
And so you've explained very well the closeness of the two countries geographically, but why have they decided to go into this trade partnership together?
I think one of the reasons is that over the years, you can see that Singapore has developed and progressed much faster, more rapidly than Malaysia has. And Singapore is a very high income nation as compared to Malaysia. Although both economies are kind of booming, I think one of the big advantages is that when you have an economic zone in Malaysia, in Johor, it allows Singapore to, number one, I think they could use the land because, you know, Singapore is a small country, so they need bigger space to expand their businesses. And coming over to Malaysia, coming over to Johor, it, I think, helps to reduce costs because manpower will be cheaper, costs will be cheaper. And definitely when you open an economic zone like this, tax incentives is going to be one of the things that's going to be expected the most. So yeah, I think that's one of the, those are the things that, you know, is going to drive the zone.
And those incentives that you mentioned are the things that are going to bring global investment to the zone as well.
Well, that's the hope. I think that's the hope. I think the hope is that because Singapore has attracted a lot of international investment, global investment, expanding an area for them to come in will allow them to expand this global investment. So I think that's that potential that they're hoping for.
Do you think the balance of who gets what out of this deal is pretty much equal, or will one country benefit more than the other?
I think it could be equal. It could be equal. I mean, thinking about, so Malaysia right now is expecting to create as many as like 100,000 new jobs and bringing in about $26 billion of income to the Malaysian economy in the next 5 years once the zone starts. And this, of course, definitely will benefit Malaysia a lot. And I think the other benefit for Singapore is that they get to expand. They need land, they need space. And expanding over into Malaysia will allow that to happen for them with reduced costs. So yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why they're coming into this agreement as well, because they see it as a win-win situation for both countries.
That was Zan Azli from Kuala Lumpur speaking to me a little earlier. And that brings us to the end of World Business Report for today. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget, you can always find a podcast of World Business Report. Search for World Business Report wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And join me again tomorrow, same time.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping 5 members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.